Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hey, Diane, what's going on?
Same old, but not really.
It's been a very quiet week in Lake Cycling Begone.
But not in the news.
No, I'm being facetious.
Oh,
here.
Okay. Yes, you are. Oh, my goodness. I stopped counting the articles and the fallout. But we might as well get it over with now. Lance Armstrong, if anybody doesn't know, you're not living in the on the planet, stepped down as the chairman of the Lance Armstrong Foundation. And I think every other sponsor except Oakley so far has pulled sponsorship. Trek, Nike, Radio Shack, Giro. It's dizzying.
I'll give him credit for doing one right thing, and that was resigning as chairman of Livestrong. You know, he must care about cancer patients more than his own ego, and I have to say that that's probably the only thing that trumps Lance Armstrong's ego.
Well, you know,
just from my observation.
And I don't disagree with you. What was interesting was my sort of personal feeling of being a little bit unsettled. You know, you see this person who went through all the crap he did with his illness, you know, and fight back from that. And then to have this kind of sort of build up to this another fall, it's almost like not he's getting sick again, but it's sort of like the same kind of thing. It's like rising, falling, you know, the phoenix rising out of the ashes. So I don't know where he's going to end up. But maybe we can look at the glass as half full. Perhaps there's a new era for cycling. Without Lance in the news every 3 seconds and the exposure that the UCI is getting for its complicity and the whole world watching, maybe cycling will finally come into some of these new, young, healthy, exciting riders like Taylor Finney.
Well, Lance did what he did because of whatever reasons he had, but he was definitely enabled by a lot of people and organizations who are still very much involved in the sport.
Yes, and so we'll see where all that falls out.
You know, and I don't know if you saw Team Sky announced that they were going to require all of their riders, support staff, directors, everyone to sign a pledge that said that they had never doped or
really?
They would be fired.
Everybody, huh?
Everybody,
well, good.
From top to bottom. Yeah, but then they took some flack to that because, you know, some people are making the counter argument that that's not an incentive to get people to come clean, you know?
Well,
and Levi Leipheimer got cut loose by Omega Pharma, which is now being called Omerta Pharma Lotto Sidestep, the new name for that team.
You know what? So it's too big to put on the back of a jersey. I don't care what anybody says.
He came clean, and for his trouble, he was summarily sacked. So who knows what the right thing is to do?
Yeah. I that's why I'm saying it might be this new young crop of riders that are just starting out. I mean, we're going to have to go through the sort of cleansing process to come up with, hopefully, something fresh. I don't know. It's a hard thing at this point.
It's a Gordian knot, that's for sure. I will say that I think you can make some distinction between riders and director sportifs and coaches, because riders can be tested.
Yes.
Going forward.
Right.
And, you know, the testing process may be imperfect and It has to have some teeth behind it. It has to be done properly. But you can test riders.
Well, and you have the biological passport, too, which gives you a baseline.
Mm-hmm. But you can't test the coaches and the DSs to see if they are encouraging or pressuring riders. Right. There's no way to know.
Right.
And so the people who have this history, like the Bruneels, et cetera, you know, is there still a place for them in the sport? Or not, because they're the ones who
enabled everybody
and who set the tone, and they're the hardest people to root out in this sort of a thing because there's no test.
Well, and the other hard part about it is that suddenly you have a lot of people who have all this experience, forgetting the doping experience for a moment, you know, the experience of having their riders do these awful things. They also have experience with coaching and with how to get their riders to perform without drugs. They know how to do that. Or a massage therapist, a good massage therapist, mm-hmm. you know, a good director sportif. I don't know what the answer to that is. It's going to be interesting to watch. So should we move on? Because there's other news.
One final comment.
Yes.
I'll say professional cycling is like religion.
Uh-oh, and I know about you and religion. Go ahead.
It's a good subject for academic study, but, you know, I don't necessarily feel the need to go to Mass every Sunday.
I got it. All right. We're moving on. There is a very interesting thing that happened this week. Felix Baumgartner, 128,000-foot free fall from space, the Red Bull-sponsored event.
Yeah.
Even though it really doesn't have anything to do with bicycling, it was a pretty astonishing sporting feat. I just can't even imagine 128,000 feet. That's a gazillion miles, even.
24, I think.
That's still a lot. That's a lot of miles. That's more miles than you fly in an airplane only all the time.
They're hoping that maybe the pressurized suit that he had to develop for this stunt may have some practical application in manned spaceflight.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
You know, I'm into the outer space thing. I like that stuff. Then there's the cardboard bike story. That's been repeated like 5 gazillion times this week, too. Israeli inventor Itzhar Gafni has been working on the idea for a long time, says it's ready for prime time. He's expecting it's going to sell for $20, is completely recyclable, and was all over the news. What do you think?
He also said that it might be able to be given away for free because they can advertise on the tubes, and the advertising might pay for it to where it can just be free.
Just give them away.
Yeah. Wow. And who would steal a $20 bike? There's no incentive. You should be able to leave that thing locked up, unlocked in
anywhere.
Any city,
mm-hmm.
and who would care?
Yeah.
Maybe it could be a bike share bike.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But then the bike share programs are SOL because, you know, they're all based on money and people are investing in these bike share programs. I don't know. You know, it's only a one-speed bicycle, by the way. It doesn't have derailleurs or anything
like that.
It's a
single speed. It's a belt drive.
Right.
It's an interesting design.
It is an interesting
design.
It's cute.
It's also a non-pneumatic tire.
That's true. It's going to ride, like, very harshly.
Yeah, so it's not for everybody or every condition. But
it's very cool, I think, as transportation in places that, you know, people cannot afford to get transportation.
Yeah, I think there would be a huge potential for that bike in Africa.
Developing countries,
yeah.
Sure. So I have one more little tidbit before we get on with the show, and that's a reminder about the Philly Bike Expo next weekend. And also let those listeners who might stop by the show that we're hosting Bike Guy, Bill Humphreys, the guy who wrote the Jersey Project book.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to be in our booth signing books.
Cool.
Isn't that kind of cool?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're very excited. If you are near the Philly Bike Expo, which is in Center City at the 23rd Street Armory next weekend, I think it's Saturday and Sunday, stop by and say hi. I'll be there probably for the whole show, like on my feet. So if I'm tired, I'm sorry. So we'll have some more news later that doesn't have to do with Lance.
Good.
And that doesn't have to do with cardboard bikes.
All right.
But here's what we have on tap for this evening. On October 9th, All Things Considered on NPR aired a 4.5 or so minute piece about a guy in Massachusetts. We talked about him last week, Ernest Gagnon. He is on the show this week. When he began cycling, or when he had this epiphany that perhaps cycling was a way for him to get over some of his issues, he weighed 570 pounds. He is more than 240 pounds lighter now. He was at the time facing surgery, complications from diabetes, and really was very embarrassed and miserable. And he just got this thing in his head that he wanted to become a cyclocross racer. I'm like, wow, that's cool. We're going to ask him why he picked cyclocross. But anyway, he and his friend and mentor Steve LaChance and another young man named Zach are going to join us this evening to talk about Ernie's progress and his very bright future right now. He did complete his first cyclocross race recently, which is very cool. Then we're going to talk with, I would say he is one of, if not the most foremost authority in the field of triathlon. Dan Emfield is the founder of Quintana Roo Bicycles, the inventor of the triathlon wetsuit, and the publisher of the Slow Twitch website, which is just a humongous site. It offers advice, information, clinics, coaching, just tons of information and a really good forum about triathlon. We'll talk to Dan about how he became so interested in the sport, how it's evolved to the sort of elite status that it has today, and his thoughts on its future. So let's get ready for another hour of the Outspoken Cyclist as we talk to Ernie Gagnon, Steve LaChance, and Zach. Hi, guys. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening.
How are you doing?
All right, you guys, stop stepping on each other. I'm going to begin with Ernie anyway, because you're the star here. I want you to give us a little bit of background on yourself.
As far as cycling is concerned?
No, as far as Ernie is concerned, like what you do, where you're from, you know, well, then we'll talk about cycling.
There you go. I'm originally from Maine. I was born there. I lived there 23 years. And then I moved to Massachusetts for work, basically. I lived in Mass, about 5-6 years. And it was New Hampshire before that, but yeah, moved there. I work in a company called Sophos. It's internet security. I basically do tech support, and now I'll be doing beta to more software antivirus type stuff. And yeah, I got into cycling from that point.
Well, the story on NPR obviously attracted a huge amount of attention, including me. And one of the things you sort of spoke about was how kind of screwed up your life was before cycling became your therapy. What was going on in your life, and about what the time frame was that?
Well, basically after college, I started going into a more depressive state. I didn't really do much. I basically went to work and back. I had kind of a rough childhood before that, and went through college, and then I found a job, and basically, that's all I did. I didn't have many friends. I kind of suffered from stuff that went through my family. You know, I didn't feel like I was particularly accepted and wanted or anything like that in this world. So I ended up just kind of spending 10 years of my life not doing a heck of a lot except eating, going to work, and maybe going to the store and back.
Were you overweight as a child?
Oh, yeah. I was always a big kid. I don't remember how much I weighed, but I was always on the large side and just became bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, I tried doing football and that stuff and never particularly liked it. I always kind of liked doing cycling, but I was always told that, oh, no, you should be doing football. You shouldn't be doing that cycling stuff. It was always – weight's always been an issue. It runs in my family.
You actually came to a point where you were being told you had to do something physically – you had diabetes and you had problems with your legs and they were looking at gastric bypass. What was the epiphany? What happened?
Well, what happened was I was talking to my doctors and they were talking about losing weight and trying to get the weight loss, weight down, because I was on the onset of having diabetes and I was having starting to show in my legs. I was starting to show all that stuff. And basically the first step was to try to get me into the gastric bypass weight loss center stuff, and they wanted me to do that. But I just couldn't see myself. I mean, I went to the programs, and I just could not see myself changing my anatomy to improve my weight situation. You know, these surgeries are not easy. They're intensive. There's tons of classes and stuff you have to do, and you're basically changing stuff to try to fix a problem that shouldn't be dealt with, as far as I'm concerned, with surgery. You know, there was either lap band or the bypass. Bypass is not really reversible once you have it done. So if it fails, you're kind of in trouble. And then you have the lap band, which is not permanent. You kind of have to have it removed after so many years, and you can kind of cheat with it. I just couldn't see doing it. And just one day, I said to myself, I got to do something. So I said, you know, what the heck, I'll start looking into cycling. And then I started adding Zach in Facebook. I talked to a bunch of bike shops on top of that. And, you know, finally one called Landry's, you know, started talking to me about the challenge. And then it started rolling from there. And then I went to a cross race to see Zach. And then I met Steve.
Let's for a moment talk to Zach, because he's the first one evidently you ran across. Zach, tell us about your first encounters with Ernie.
It was a couple years ago at the Canton Cyclocross race. Beforehand, he'd added me on Facebook, and I really had no idea who it was. There's some pictures of bicycles on his profile, and that was about it. But it was clear that it was someone who was, you know, trying to use the bikes to lose weight. So it's like, okay, sure. And I don't remember exactly what was said, but I responded to something which was, "Hey, you should come out to Canton and watch the race."
Yeah, I don't remember what that was.
And I got a message from him, which was, "Oh, I'd like to, but can I meet you there?" So I said, "Sure." So that was the first time I met him, when he came out and watched the race. And then we started doing some riding after that.
So, Steve, how about you? How did you meet Ernie and then get involved with this whole getting Ernie on bike routine?
I actually met Ernest after probably 8 months of him riding with Zach and a couple other guys. It was after a while. It wasn't right at the beginning. But he reached out to me on Facebook like everybody else, and I had the same trepidation of a person. You know, he doesn't have a profile picture. You know, generally when people friend you on Facebook without a profile picture, you're a little leery of what's behind that. But I said, you know what, I've heard about it through a couple of people. I'm going to meet him up. And he invited me to his birthday party, which was actually at Zach's apartment, and there was one stipulation, that you had to come in spandex. So, you know, I said, what the heck? I wear it all the time racing and riding. Why not wear it to, you know, go to a barbecue and hang out with people? So I did. And we met up. I had a great time at the party. And then from there, it just kind of snowballed into riding every once in a while and talking every once in a while. And now, I mean, Ernest and I have been seeing each other once or twice a week for the last year.
And so you ride together, and one of the things I want to know, Ernie, and I know you've lost a lot of weight. As of the last I heard, it was over 240 pounds.
Yep.
I assume this has been life-changing for you, riding, and this is the key to why we're talking today, how this has changed your life. What are you doing besides riding a bike that is getting you back into shape?
There's a lot to this. It's kind of funny. You know, a lot of people talk to me about, you know, the weight loss and whatnot. I think a lot of the reason why I'm losing a lot of weight is because I have a social life now. I didn't have a social life beforehand.
Interesting.
You know, yeah, because I go out and go to parties. I talk to people. I'm happier. I'm not depressed because food became my only friend when I was dealing with my depression. I ate because I felt better about who I was and whatnot. For temp, you know, it was comfort. Now I go out and I see people, I talk to people. I'm happier. It's the social aspect is that the depression is. It takes over your life, and when you're happier and you're more willing to do stuff and go out, you move more. You just do stuff more, and you know, you're not eating to please an issue. You can actually taste the food. You're not shoving it in your mouth because it makes you feel better. You know, there's so many elements to it.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Ernie Gagnon, Zach Labrie, and Steve LaChance, and we're going to talk about cyclocross racing. Why did you choose cyclocross of all the cycling disciplines?
You know, I always liked the idea of riding a bike off-road and the whole mud aspect, and I kind of like mountain biking, road biking, and it was just, I don't know why I like it so much. It just seemed really cool, and I wanted to try it. It seemed like a more inviting atmosphere, too. I think that's what it was. The people were more laid back. It just seemed to be a little more inviting. And, you know, with mountain biking and road biking and road cycling, you kind of have to go long, long distances, and I figured, well, if I was going to try cyclocross, at least I'm only less than a mile away from the center of the course, and if I crashed and died, somebody can come hit me.
So tell us about, just briefly, your experience of your first cyclocross race, which you recently completed, I understand.
Yeah, no, I've actually done 4 cyclocross
races. Oh, even better.
It's 4. Yeah, 4 races.
Okay.
My friend Cosmo was there. I was a little nervous. It was unique. I, you know, was painful.
Painful?
It was painful.
How many miles was it?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, how many laps was it?
I did three laps.
Okay.
Five. Four or five. You're in my race.
Four, five, six.
Okay.
I lost track the same as you did.
So how long did it take?
It was, the race was 40 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. So you were like racing hard for 40 minutes. And you came across the line dead last, from what I understand?
Dead last. It was unique because I've done a cyclocross race kind of before that. I put one on before, called Relay Cross, and that was in, what was it, December or January? I forget what it was, last year. We put on a cyclocross race with Andy Huff. He was one of the guys who was part of that, and we put a relay cross. The idea was to get racers and newbies to race side by side, and it's basically like you do when you do track. You hand a baton, do the course, and
right.
do it on from there. And that was kind of my, I guess, first race of sorts. Then I did this one, the official one, in Midnight Cross in Lancaster.
Tell us a little bit about your bike. I know that it's a titanium frame and that it is, I know it's a 7. How did you choose that bike for yourself? Obviously, Landry's helped you, but how did you come to choose that particular bike?
That's a Zach question.
Okay, Zach.
It was actually Zach's idea about the whole custom thing.
So, Zach, tell me how you decided to move into a Thai bike.
So it was actually my roommate, Alex Chaliff, and I at the time were noticing that his bike was a bit inadequate. It was getting the job done, but not particularly gracefully at the time. And, we were trying to brainstorm ideas to help him get him set up on something that would fit him better. But it's a bit complicated. I mean, there's the weight issue, and so you want to, go for durability. But Ernest also has kind of strange proportions.
Yes.
So even if he weighed as much as I do, stock geometry just wouldn't really work out for him. So that's how we kind of started brainstorming about custom bikes, and 7 was the first thing that popped into our mind. So we talked with Landry's and kind of brainstormed how it was going to be set up, how you get the handlebars wide enough, what kind of gearing it needed, whether it's going to be a cross bike or a mountain bike or somewhere in between. So that's sort of the process that happens.
So, Steve, tell me, you haven't said much, so I'm going to come up to you and say, what do you get out of all this with Ernie?
That's a pretty powerful question. When I met Ernest, he was very reserved, and he almost had a shell that he was putting on whenever he interacted with you. He was very guarded about all his interactions, very hesitant. And every time I see him, little by little, he's always coming out of that shell and getting more confident. And for me, a lot of it is seeing Ernest develop into just the person I know he is inside, and having that ability to show the great guy that Zach and I know to everybody that meets him, rather than being reserved and holding back who he really is. Because he's an awesome friend. He's got amazing amounts of integrity. He's generous with his time. He cares about everybody, no matter what. And he's extremely accepting, and he's got all these incredible traits, and I love to see him grow into those traits and express them in all situations.
Wow, Ernest, you have some great friends. That's awesome. So I have one last big question. What piece of advice would you give to somebody who faces obstacles, not necessarily weight, but whatever obstacles, like you did, and wants to break out of the shell, as Steve says?
You got to accept yourself first. You got to start loving yourself first. Once you've accepted who you are, you can do all kinds of stuff. You can't accept who you are and you've got all these walls around you, you can't do anything. You really, really need to love who you are as a person before you can fix stuff. Having these guys around helped me understand that a lot.
Well, we certainly will keep watching you race that bicycle. And I think it's a wonderful story. I really enjoyed talking with the three of you. And I know it's just cross racing is just opened up for the season here. So you've got lots to do this winter.
Yes, I do.
All right.
And road, you know, I'm going to do road too. So we'll see what happens.
Oh, very cool. Well, maybe we'll find out how your road racing goes in the spring. Thank you so much, Ernie and Zach and Steve, for talking with us this evening on the show. Have a great fall riding season.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ernest Gagnon, Steve LaChance, and Zach LaBrie joined us from Billerica, Massachusetts, where cross season is getting into swing.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, the Providence Cyclocross Fest was, what, last week? Or the week before, yeah. So cross is happening on the East Coast, and I guess these guys are taking full advantage of it.
Well, they've got one more racer in the ranks this season.
Yeah, what an interesting story.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
very much.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, the story's been around NPR, Velo News, and now the most important of all, of course, the Outspoken Cyclist. Oh, that's self-importance. We should kill that.
We're gonna take a half a minute break here and see if we can deflate Diane's head. It might take more than 30 seconds.
Stick a pin in it.
We'll be back in 30 seconds regardless on The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
On Friday, October 26th, from 7 to 8 p.m., you can join Cleveland Metro Parks for a family Friday night creepy campfire in the park. Explore what goes bump in the night with a look at some nocturnal animals. Bring a scary story to share around the campfire while roasting marshmallows. It all takes place at North Chagrin Nature Center's Nature Education Building, located behind the center off Buttermilk Falls Road near the Sunset Lane entrance of North Chagrin Reservation. More information at clevelandmetroparks.com.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist, and we're going to take just a short bit of time here to talk about some more cycling news.
We are, and it's not a whole bunch of stuff. There was other stuff besides Lance Armstrong and his demise this week. One of the stories, and I've been watching it, you may or may not have heard of it. Last month, Quality Bicycle Products, you know who QBP is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, probably the largest distributor of parts in the independent bicycle distribution network, filed a lawsuit against a company we used to deal with a lot called Sinclair Imports for selling product below cost on an online store called Bike Baron. This week, Sinclair answered the suit, and we were kind of wondering what it would be. So this comes from Minneapolis, Minnesota, from Bicycle Retailer and Industry News. Sinclair Imports President Lance Donald defended his right to maintain a discount website this week in response to QBP's lawsuit alleging unfair competition. In an email to Brain, Donald said a Bike Baron, the website named in the suit, sells closeout inventory that does not conflict with the interest of Sinclair's brick-and-mortar retail customers, which was the concern from QBP. But wait, there's more. Quote, being forced to sell closeout inventory below cost, sometimes for 50 cents on the dollar or less at the end of the year, has become an unsustainable model. We offer the same inventory to retailers for substantially less than products are sold for on Bike Baron, but more often our retailers are little interested in closeout inventory, Donald said. QBP is accusing the Nevada-based Sinclair of using Bike Baron and an eBay site to sell directly to consumers while purporting to sell only through specialty retailers. The page title of the Bike Baron website, however, reads Quality Bike Parts, which comes up in a web search for Bike Baron, and it creates confusion about the source of the product. Sinclair has also targeted its ad and sales efforts in Minnesota, where QBP is based, the suit says. So it will be interesting. I'm not a lawyer, but it sounds to me as if QBP might have the upper hand on this one. It doesn't sound very good for
So the page
Sinclair.
Title was Quality Bike Parts,
Parts.
Instead of Products.
Right. Yeah. No hearings have been scheduled yet. So I have one more about Bob Harrow. Do you know who he is?
No.
Mr. BMX. So sometimes the idea of a new bike is not only to ride or race it, but to enter it into a competition of some sort. Bob Harrow entered his new 17.5-pound Iconix SX1 BMX bike in the Design to Win competition in London this year. So there's an exhibit. It runs through November 18th at the Design Museum in London, designmuseum.org. And Bob Harrow posted on Facebook this beautiful yellow BMX bike, the iconic SX1 BMX bike, 17 and a half pounds. So he's hoping it wins some awards, which I think would be very cool. I like that idea because we don't hear a lot about BMX. So let's move along then, because our next guest is just nothing less than awesome. Dan Emfield, I've known him for probably close to 30 years. As far as I'm concerned, I don't think anybody knows as much about triathlon from the ground up as he does. He is the publisher of Slow Twitch. Let's welcome him to the show. Dan, thanks for joining us this evening.
Oh, it's great to be here. I've wanted to do the show for a long time. Thanks so much for inviting me.
It's my pleasure. We've known each other a long time. And in those many years, you've developed an enormous library of triathlon information, training and racing and bike fit. And I remember carrying Kiru wetsuits years and years and years ago. Can you tell me a little bit about your early background and how you got into the triathlon business?
Well, it was completely by accident. People come to me relatively frequently with ideas that they think would be a good business, and they ask me about them. And I guess my answers are kind of disingenuous in a way, because I look at it from the point of view, wow, is this a good product, and are you adequately financed? Basically, I underwrite them as if they were someone completely different than the person I was when I started in the business. I really wanted to be what I am right now, which is someone who writes articles for people who do triathlons.
So is your background actually journalism?
No.
Oh,
I have a Bachelor of Science degree in biology, which prepares you for absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
But it was fun. I don't regret it. But, that was my background. And I was just doing triathlons. And I approached Bob Babbitt, who has been a friend of mine for a billion years. He was then publishing, editing a magazine called Running and Triathlon News, which morphed into Competitor Magazine.
Okay.
Which morphed into Competitor Group, which is now Rock and Roll Marathons and all of that stuff.
Right.
And I said, hey, I've been noticing that my buddies that I'm racing against, they don't seem to go any slower when they put on their surf wetsuits on. I wonder why that is. I wonder what would happen if you optimized a wetsuit for surface swimming. Would you actually even go faster? And Bob said, yeah, fine, go ahead, knock yourself out, write the article. So I did some research and worked with a wetsuit manufacturer that had a factory, and worked with a rubber manufacturer, and made some prototypes, which are very similar to what wetsuits look like today. And I got in the pool and I swam 100 yards, and I realized that I had a lot more than just an article.
Yeah, no kidding.
And that's kind of how I got started.
Well, I remember when we first started carrying wetsuits, it was a lot of sizes and it was lengths, and it was a business unlike what I was used to in the bike shop. So you sort of had to have a new language and a new way of approaching it. So you transitioned from wetsuits to bicycles. How did that happen? So you went Kiru wetsuits. Now it's Kiru aluminum bikes.
Well, I want to comment on something you just mentioned, which is people don't appreciate some of the decisions that we had to make back then. Because we didn't create a new product. We created a new category of products. So where do you sell a wetsuit for triathletes? Do you sell it in a bike shop, or do you sell it in a surf shop or a scuba shop, shops like that? That was, and, you ask that question today, and, well, it's obvious. But it wasn't obvious back then, because I can't tell you, well, you can relate, but few people can relate to me calling up a bike shop and saying, well, I've got this product, it's wetsuits, the triathletes wear them. I mean, no one had any idea that they would make you faster. Everyone assumed they would just be for warmth.
Interesting.
And so the bike shop guy, would say, well, I'm sure you have the wrong number, sir. but, there's a surf shop down the road, and that's really who you should be talking to. We are a bike shop, you understand that. so that was really the quality of the conversation I was having. So it was interesting, but I transitioned into bikes only because I was a triathlete, and 1987 was just this year of technology. I came out with the first wetsuits that were commonly considered triathlon wetsuits that triathletes wanted, and Boone Lennon, who is a dear friend of mine, came out with the new Scott DH handlebar.
I remember that.
So both came out in 1987. And as I was doing triathlons then, I was an early adopter of Scott DH handlebars. And it didn't really take very long before all of us who had these handlebars were figuring out how to best use the bars. And really what it came down to is the bar was the most important thing. So we adapted and adopted everything about the bike to optimize the use of the aero bars.
Interesting. I mean, so, it makes sense knowing what I know now. Sure.
Yeah. Well, so then it was, well, rather than having these strange bent or oddly welded dog leg seat posts, which, you know, and we were all getting those, we were having those welded up.
Some of them were being made right here in Ohio.
Yes.
Those titanium ones. I can't remember the guy's name now, but yeah.
It escapes me.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Anyway, you know, my thinking was, why not build a bike frame underneath the bar, assuming that you're starting with the bar? So that was the first tri bike, and that came out in 89. And, you know, you have to have luck. And the first guy that said, yeah, I'll use that bike, was Ray Browning. And no one knew who Ray Browning was. And I said, okay, fine. He said, got this race coming up, Ironman New Zealand. So here's the bike. Because we already sponsored him for wetsuits. And he took the bike down there. And he, you know, Scott Tinley was in the race. And
right.
Some other good guys. He creamed everybody. I mean, creamed everybody.
Wow.
And that kind of put us on the map.
Well, and they were radical for their day. Because as I remember, they were basically 650 wheels.
Yeah, they were 650 wheels. We already had some experience with 650 wheels because my actual first beginning bike product was I was, you know, sponsoring some triathletes, men and women both, and one of the things that really bothered me was the inability for the women I was sponsoring to ride a bike that fit them properly. So I thought, this is silly. So I just thought, well, you know, let's just downsize the wheels in the same percentage that we're downsizing the bike. So we built women's bikes with 650C wheels, and Liz Downing was one of our athletes. And I remember hearing so much blowback about 650 wheels. They're slower. So we went out to Moriarty, New Mexico, Liz and I, and we bought her a USCF license, and she did her one and only bike race of her career. She did a 40K time trial on that women's bike. And she set a new national record for women, for 40 kilometers. She promptly retired from bike racing, went back to dominating duathlons, which in those days was were called biathlons.
Yeah, run, bike, run.
Right.
Right.
And that was that. And that pretty much shut up the people who said that 650 wheels were slow. And really, since 1989 or thereabouts, the only women who have ever won the Hawaiian Ironman on 700C wheels are women that are tall enough to not need 650 wheels, such as McKeely Jones and Karen Smyers and Chrissy Wellington. But all the other ones, Miranda and Paula and, Lori Bowden and Natasha, you know, all those gals, Heather, they all rode 650 wheels or smaller. And so we already had some background in the 650s, and we wanted shorter chain stays anyway to get the weight displacement correct on the men's bikes. So we built those bikes with dual 650s. But the most important thing we did with those bikes was steepen the seat angle.
Right. That was going to be my next comment about the seat angles.
Yeah, and that survives today. The 650 wheel, you know, under 50 centimeters, that's pretty common in tri bikes. But the most common legacy of those early bikes was the seat angles, which varied from 78 to 80 degrees, and now most companies are making 78, 79 degrees for their newer tri-bike designs.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dan Empfield. He is, as far as I'm concerned, Mr. Triathlon. He is the publisher of Slow Twitch, which is an outstanding website. And you can also get more information than just triathlon information there. There's all kinds of stuff. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But something you said just sort of rang a bell in my head. There has been so much discussion about, quote unquote, getting more women into cycling. What is the percentage of women who are in the sport of triathlon? Because I think somebody's missing something here.
Well, it's about 33-34% as far as I can tell.
Which is way higher than in other areas of cycling, from urban all the way through competitive road and cyclocross and, you know, mountain and all of that.
Well, it's funny, you know. I was at the Tour California time trial last year in Solvang, and there were exhibition in that in the time trial where they invited, I don't know, 8 or 10 or 12 top female time trialists. You know, it was Kristen Armstrong and Emma Pooley and all these world champions, Olympic champions, and so forth. Had them all out there, and I was talking to Emma Pooley, and I said, you know, it's funny because I think a lot of these gals, some of these gals at least, Heather Jackson, who is still a triathlete, and some of the other ones started as triathletes, she said, no, sweetheart, almost all of us started as triathletes.
Right.
There is no entree into bicycle racing for women. There is no window into bike racing. The window is through triathlon, because triathlon is women-friendly. She said, I was a triathlete, Kristen was a triathlete, Heather's a triathlete, Ray Shaw was a triathlete, and she started whipping off all the names. And the interesting thing was, not only was the majority of the field current or former triathletes, but the fact that Emma knew that, and, you know, here was the reigning world UCI time trial champion.
Right.
Soon to be dethroned by the current Olympic time trial champion, both of whom were triathletes.
It just occurred to me that, you know, this is the entree for so many women into the sport. It's very cool. So can we talk about Slow Twitch?
Sure, I'd love to.
I know. That's what is the title? What does it mean? And how did you come up with it for this website?
Well, most of the time people refer to type 1 and type 2 muscle fibers. And they're the sorts of fibers, the kinds of muscle fibers that you have if you are predominantly either an endurance athlete or a ballistic type athlete, sprinter, shot putter, something like that. In times past, these were frequently referred to as slow twitch fibers and fast twitch fibers. And slow twitch fibers are the ones that you have if you're predominantly an endurance athlete. And I chose that name for two reasons. One, it was available.
Like a .com?
I could get the domain name.
Right.
And the other is, I wanted to publish an online magazine for people who did triathlons, but I have a lot of interests beyond simply racing in swim bike run races. And so I didn't want to hem or hedge in what I wanted to write about, what I wanted to feature on Slow Twitch, by choosing a name that strictly circumscribed what we would feature. And so Slow Twitch cast a broader net. And I, you know, I still want to do that. The stuff that interests me, for example, okay, I just got back from the Hawaiian Ironman and brought back my annual infection from hell. which is in my lungs. So
I'm sorry.
Actually, it's the infection from heaven because I got back. I caught it in Hawaii.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, so on the Wednesday before, a bunch of us get on our bikes. There's this road that goes right from Kailua Bay, I mean straight uphill, and it doesn't stop until you're over 5,000 feet in elevation.
Nice.
And so we all got on our bikes and did that. And then the next day, one of the guys, he goes out, and he has this idea in his mind. He's going to swim, you know, some swim in Kailua Bay and ride out the upper road to the saddle road, right out the saddle road to the turn off to Mauna Kea. go up to 9,700 feet on his bike, where you have to then stop and put on your running shoes and go up to 13,000 or whatever the top thing is. And that was his idea of what he wanted to do. Now, we had our guy, Tim Carlson, go out there and photograph it, but he was not able to do the whole thing because of just simple time constraints with other things he had to do. But these are the sorts of things that interest me. These kind of lifestyle things, these sorts of things that people do under human-powered locomotion, using the tools available to them that triathlon has taught them. And so if you add to that, I don't know, Nordic skiing, horseback riding, stand-up paddling, all that stuff, the kinds of things that you can do when you have that skill set, the sorts of places you can go, that is what fascinates me. That's what interests me.
So you're saying that slow twitch is more than just triathlon. It is lifestyle for people who are endurance, even if it's just thinking athletes.
Well, it's what I aspire for it
okay.
to be. Now, you might say, well, you know, dude, the thing is now 13 years old, so why don't you get off your keister and make it what you want? Instead of telling us 13 years after you founded the site what it is you aspire for it to be. And that would be a very fair criticism, because we haven't done enough lifestyle stuff. But sometimes you don't do the important things because you're so busy with the urgent things.
Well, and it sort of has a life of its own, slow twitch. I mean...
Oh, you can say that again, and boy, sometimes that drives me crazy.
Well, because you're the publisher, but you're not the only contributor, as far as I can tell.
Well, we have about, I don't know, a dozen contributors. I think we have maybe 15 people.
Okay.
But, you know, we've got a finance person, and we've got an ad coordinator who sticks all the ads up for the advertisers, and we've got an ad salesman and stuff like that. But we have maybe about a dozen contributors.
Right.
However, that's not exactly true.
Okay.
We really have some tens of thousands of contributors.
Exactly. If you read the site.
That's the part that can get hairy, and it's also the part that's really invigorating. You know, there is nothing as motivating to do things right than to have 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 or 40,000 people peer reviewing you publicly in real time.
Wow.
And that's what we have, and we have it in a variety of ways. You know, you can go to Slow Twitch, you read an article, and then we have a Facebook utility where you can write right there, appending right to the article, how rotten you think my article was that I just wrote. And if you want to have a further conversation, you can go on our reader forum where we host about 2,500 posts every day. And, you know, we have to moderate that. And, sometimes I would like to remind our readers, and occasionally I do, but, you know, I think I'm pretty gentle with our readers because I appreciate them so much. But, you know, every, I don't know, third day, I think, in word count, the Old Testament is written on our reader form. It's something like almost 800,000 words over a span of 3 days.
Well, maybe you could have on there, okay, please keep your post to X number of words. Jeez.
Oh, man.
That would never happen, huh?
No. No way. You know, for example, of course, obviously there's a lot of Lance Armstrong's in the news and...
Oh, yes.
And so we try to keep the number of threads, discussions about Lance Armstrong and topics proximate to that, limited to a number of threads that are manageable, both for us to moderate and also for our readers to kind of keep track of.
And how many threads is that?
Oh, I'd say I'd like it to be one. But, I mean, I can live with maybe four or five.
Yeah.
Because sometimes the topics do really require their own thread. For example, you know, if you want to talk about, I mean, there's just a lot of aspects of it's a multi-headed monster, and so I don't want to tell all these people who have things to say, well, this is what you're going to say and how you're going to say it and where you're going to say it and when you're going to say it and how much of it you're going to say. I don't want to do that. We have what I think are pretty simple, easy to understand, not too many rules. But sometimes we have topics. This is one of them. And there's other ones. You know, we have a forum called the Lavender Room, and it's for people who want to talk about stuff that does not have anything to do with triathlon. Now, you go into the Lavender Room at your own peril. We very loosely moderate that forum. And it's because the people in there, because I've asked them, and they say, nah, you know what, just leave us alone, we're fine. But it's like, you know, religion, abortion, and, you know, it's Romney the crook, Obama the coward, and it's, I mean, just, you know, and people just tear each other to pieces.
Why would you have that on the Slow Twitch site? Just out of curiosity, because people just rant, need a rant?
I'll tell you why. Triathletes are a special breed of people.
That's true.
They are, on average, smarter, more civil, more respectful of others, and so forth. So as bad as the Lavender Room is, if you wanted to have those discussions somewhere else, it would be an order of magnitude worse.
Yeah, probably brutal.
So these people, actually, if you're grading on a curve, are, I mean, almost tender with each other.
Huh.
They really care about each other. And of course, what's great about forums like this, communities like this, is people, you would not know these people if you saw them, if you walked past them on the street. You know, they live 1,000 miles away from you. They live on in another hemisphere. But they kind of become your friends.
Sure.
So they, you know, they're horrible with each other, but in a kind of a tender way. I mean, they're very protective of each other. Even if you don't ascribe to that fellow's political persuasion. So it's actually, in a way, kind of a safe place to talk about politics and, you know, stuff like that. If there is any safe place to talk about that.
And not have your head bitten off.
Right.
Well, you know, I had like 30 other kinds of questions, but I think the conversation we're having is much more interesting than the questions I originally sent to you to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have a lot more time. I want to do two things. One, I want to ask that you'll come back and talk to me again at a future time and say
love
yes.
You.
Okay.
Love
the last thing I do want to talk about, and I mean, the encouragement will be for people to go to slowtwitch.com and just look around because it is mammoth and you could spend days there. So if you want to get lost when it's here, especially icy and cold and snowy, before the new tri season, I think that's great. Do you have one single piece of advice for somebody who would like to try a triathlon to put her or him on a successful path? One piece of advice.
Well, first of all, thank you for the kind words. In answer to your question, one thing that I don't want to scare anybody, but one thing that bothers me is although the rate of people who have bad things happen to them in triathlon is about the same as the rate in marathon running, for example, I encourage people to take some time, and especially the men, see their cardiologist. And I would, by the way, say the same thing if you said, well, you know, a guy wants to run a 10K, a guy wants to run a half marathon, what do you think he should do? See the cardiologist, have a basic run-up, don't spend a ton, but have an EKG, and, you know, whatever the cardiologist recommends, and make sure things are okay. Sometimes you find things out.
Right.
And then also, we have this kind of, I think it's a myth, it's a big, you know, among our readers there's a big debate about this, but I think the swim is a lot more important than most of my readers think it is. And I really encourage people to get into a master swim program, stretch yourself when it comes to swimming. Do things that are uncomfortable, and what I mean is not so much uncomfortable in terms of swimming out as far as you can into the ocean and then turning around. I don't mean that. I mean, get involved in swim programs where you are afraid you will look like a fool. Get involved in uncomfortable things in that way, because those folks are going to quickly help you become better swimmers, and you'll be surprised at how patient they'll be with you.
That's a great piece of advice. Great piece of advice, because I always tell people the swim, while you make up more time perhaps on your bike, the swim is a dangerous thing if you've never been out there. But you're right. Master swim programs work really, really well. That's great. Thanks, Dan.
Oh, my pleasure. And by the way, we used to get a hard time among the master swimmers, the master swimming crowd back in the mid-1980s, because there were only a few triathletes and a bunch of master swimmers. Now triathlon's kind of taken over master swimming. So
yeah, you have to look for those classes, those groups.
Yeah.
Well, I wish we had another 5 hours, because, you know, I've only known you for like 30 years. So we would have plenty more to say. So I am inviting you back. And you did say yes. And I have it on good authority that you're going to do that.
Be my pleasure.
And we'll talk again soon. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Dan Empfield joined us from Southern California.
Yes. Isn't he interesting?
Yeah.
I think he's forgotten more about triathlon than almost anybody on the planet even knows today.
He has a great common sense approach.
Yes.
His recommendation to see a doctor, cardiologist, kind of get checked out before you jump into some high-intensity competitive event. Good advice.
It is good advice. And there's a lot of it on Slow Twitch. It's a really, really excellent website. You could get lost on Slow Twitch days at a time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Too many people jump into this ill-prepared and find out the hard way that they have some sort of hidden health issue, and sometimes quite tragically. So
yeah,
it's not a bad idea to just kind of get a baseline, if nothing else.
Well, and I thought his comments about entering a master swim program, you know, around here, I know of several. Case Western Reserve has one, Beachwood has one, Solon, I think, has one. And you know what? I thought his approach to it was very good, that, you know, so be a fool for a minute, but you'll learn so much in those situations.
It's really the same with cycling or running. You only improve when you do it with people who are better than you are.
Right. Challenge.
Yeah. And they have the more experience, the better techniques. And if you just hang around with people who are at your same level.
Yeah, you never get any better, really.
You all learn how to do the same thing.
To the same level.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. All right. I think that's enough for this week.
Yes.
More than enough, perhaps.
Next week, I will be in Philadelphia for the show.
Mm-hmm.
We will probably do the show a little ahead of time, because I don't know how much time I'm going to have in Philadelphia.
Sure, yeah.
And we'll have some interesting people.
Okay.
All right.
We'll see you then.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.